Hey guys, it's Carlos Garcia with Behind the Stick Podcast. With this episode, I got the chance to interview Matt McCullough. Matt McCullough was a huge influential bartender in the state of Arizona. He now works for Southern Glaziers as a sales rep. In this episode, we get the chance to talk to him about how he got started in this industry, and it was actually at a Chuck E. Cheese, as well as the time he got to meet and interact with Robin Williams. Why don't you start by just introducing your name, where you're from, where do you work?
My name is Matt McCullough. I'm originally from California. I live in Arizona now. And I currently work for Southern Glaziers Wine and Spirits as a sales representative.
Nice. So how'd you get into this liquor industry? How'd that come about?
First job I ever had was in a restaurant. Was at Chuck E. Cheese. I didn't serve the beer or booze there, but it started me in restaurants and then came out to Arizona, came for college. And first two jobs I got, one was in retail and one was in a restaurant.
Okay.
And then from there, I started out as like a host and then a dishwasher and busser and then server. And then they're like, do you want to learn how to cook? I'm like, sure. So then they moved me to the kitchen. And then I was cooking and serving. Then a bartender called out one night. They're like, you want to try bartending? I'm like, sure. Just like serving, right? They're like, yeah, sure. So they gave me an old school red Mr. Boston's book and a jigger. And they're like, here, have fun.
Nice. So how was that first night?
I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was looking for. I knew random bottles. I knew how to pour a beer. I knew what the wines were. I had an idea of roughly how big they were, but I didn't know like cocktails or drinks. And luckily for me, that was 99, 2000. So it was before Arizona got the craft cocktail craze and before like there was big things going on. It was the TGI Fridays. So it was the Cape Cods and the Cuba Libres and the nothing specials, the Washington apples every once in a while.
Okay. Did that first night like scare you away or did it make you want to dive into this industry more?
I stayed with that, rotating between serving, bartending, and cooking. It was at Lone Star Steakhouse. I did that for about 2 years. Then I went to another local restaurant. Actually, I guess my local was a national chain. It was Houlihan's. Uh-huh. And the Houlihan's and the Biltmore at the time had a little club. So I would go get out of school and I'd go to work at 5 o'clock. I'd go cook in the kitchen. I'd be like the broiler cook or do whatever. I'd get done at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. I'd leave. I'd go home, shower, change, come back. And then I would bartend in the club until at that time the law was 1, I believe. And then I'd go home and do whatever homework I could do. Wake up, go to school, and classes start at like 7. So, yeah, it was a rough portion, a lot of hours.
So, now that you're a rep for Southern, did you, like, just want to stay in this industry or did it kind of just fall in your lap? How did you transition into staying in it?
So, I was going to school for engineering. Got engineering degree. And I worked in the engineering field for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. 9/11 happened, and my company that I was originally hired with lost a lot of contracts. They were in the middle of expanding, and they overexpanded at the wrong time. So They ended up going bankrupt about 6-9 months after 9/11. I was actually on a job assignment in Sacramento when I was still like bartending like 1 or 2 days a week. You know, it was Friday or Saturday just to have extra cash. It's easier to save money if you have not going out to the bar and spending it. Mm-hmm. And it was a great way to meet extra girls, especially when you were traveling and I was single. So it was great. Company went bankrupt. And then I started getting hired at Peace Rate through other companies. Well, Peace Rate means I work now for 3 months, 4 months, however long the job is. And then the job's done. I'm done. Uh-huh. So then I got to find another job every time. Well, restaurants always were there for me and provided stable income for me. So I decided to leave my engineering field and go full time into restaurants. So then I went hotel, restaurants, and nightclubs, and I did that, you know, full time at that point.
So how long would you say overall you've been bartending?
19 years.
19 years. Since you have been bartending for 19 years, what are some of the most important pieces of advice you would share to anyone in this industry or trying to get started?
Number one, it's your customer service. So you're there for somebody else's means. I mean, you're there to serve them. I mean, you're there for them. I mean, like, you're providing a service for them. And then in turn for that, I mean, hopefully you get nice tips and whatnot, but you're in a service position.
Overall hospitality, you'd say.
Yeah. They're not wrong, but they're not 100% right. I mean, they're more right than wrong. Like, there's no such thing as a bad drink. If somebody wants to spend $200 and drink Louis Trey and Coke, it's their money. I'm not making them do it, you know. Don't judge people on their taste and their palate. There's no, you know, everybody has something that they like, and everybody likes something different.
Yeah, it's that weird walking the balance on, like, I think educating them, like, oh, why do you like this? And then just saying, you're completely wrong. I think a lot of people forget that nowadays with the craft, like, oh, that's the right way. I still don't like it. Like, what do you mean?
At the end of the day, it's subjective. It's your taste palate's different than my taste palate. I have a tart, bitter taste palate. Uh-huh. I like more stringent cocktails. I like bitter cocktails. I like alcohol-forward cocktails. I enjoy the flavor of alcohol. When writing cocktail menus, I would know that my palate isn't the, not generic palate, but the masses palate. I'd make my drink sweeter on the menu to do that. Or you'd know who you're talking to. You have to figure out what their likes are.
Do you think a lot of people in this industry forget that nowadays or no?
I think sometimes it gets overlooked. I think a lot of key people do know it. I think it's some of the people that are up and coming and trying to make a bigger name for themselves forget it, and they think that they're going to be the second coming, the next great thing, which they might be, but at the end of the day, we're still in this customer service based industry, and you know what? They're not always right. Mm-hmm. Just because that's what they like doesn't mean that's what everybody else likes.
True. When you were beginning this career, what are some of the obstacles you faced?
Going up against female bartenders, because a girl with big boobs and a pretty face and pretty smile was getting a job before I was. Didn't matter if she knew what she was doing, if she didn't know what she was doing. If she knew what she was doing, you know, more power to her. I just was going up against pretty girls that had no idea what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they're just thrown behind the bar as a figure piece. And, you know, they'd make money, but they wouldn't make a good drink, or they wouldn't be efficient, or they'd call out sick, or, you know, her boyfriend's taking her to Jamaica, so now she's taking the week off.
So would you say this industry sometimes puts that ahead in a negative way and, like, overlooks the skill, or do you think we're slowly transitioning out of that?
It depends on the style of bar. I think it actually flipped the other way now. Mm-hmm. Now I think those don't get a fair shake when they're going to mixology cocktail bars and stuff. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of the craft cocktail bars and the mixology bars, the fancier places, all male staffed now instead of having females in there, thinking that females can't keep up. And I know there's many girls that can make a drink just as good, if not better, than most of the guys. It seems to be more prevalent to see a female in a neighborhood sports bar or a nightclub than it is a craft cocktail bar.
So as you're going through and becoming a better bartender and you were learning more, what are ways you focused on growing your knowledge and your skills in order to get to that status and get better off in your industry?
Trying new things, experimenting, reading, buying old bar books. The Mr. Boston's book was the one that was most easily available and easily found at the time, early 2000s, late 90s. Mm-hmm. And that was the one that seemed to be like the Bible behind every bar at one point. So looking through that and going, why is this drink popular and why is that drink popular? And I was working in a hotel. I was working for JW Marriott for actually about 4 or 5 years, and then working in the service wellness, I'd always have a Negroni come through. And nowadays, a Negroni is a common drink. Mm-hmm. But mid-2000s, it wasn't a drink that was too common. And I'm sitting there going, what is this? Why do people like this? And I'm like, all this Campari stuff's nasty and it's super bitter. Now it's gotten to the point of where, you know, it's one of my favorite drinks if made right. And it's the easiest drink to make, you know, three ingredients, equal parts, but people seem to mess it up all the time.
Mm-hmm. That and like a martini, I would say three ingredients, but if you don't have the proportions right, it doesn't taste anything like it should.
Right. Okay. Or if you like don't store your vermouth properly, if you keep it out, which you still see.
Yeah.
In every other bar.
Is there one book that you would recommend or any other, like a handful of books that you would say are necessary to learn the things you should learn as a bartender?
So many books. I mean, like, it depends on where you want to go. I mean, you got Dale DeGroff's book, you know, Dale the Cocktail, Art of the Cocktail, whatever it's called, is a great one. If you want to just like go through old vintage books and just start reading old recipes, I mean, those are really cool to go through too. Go through like the old Savoys and go through, the Jerry Thomas Bible and all that stuff. You know, some of these books don't have much for background or why the drinks are this way and what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them do. I mean, the easiest thing and like the best thing I can think of nowadays, especially with all the stuff that's out there, is just find somebody, and if you're eager and young enough to do it, just find somebody to learn under. Mm-hmm. Figure out why you do things certain ways and why it's done this way as opposed to that way.
That's a good one. That a lot of people overlook that as a trade. They say think you have to go to school and learn it nowadays, but some of the best things I've learned personally are through other bartenders who have been doing it for like 20 some years.
Right. And then there's different styles of bartending, and there's not one that's better than the other. I mean, I've gone through and I worked for Bahama Breeze for a while. So Bahama Breeze does their bartender training with a company called Flare Tenders. So they taught you how to flare bartend. Mm-hmm. PGA Fridays does the same thing. And they do that whole corporate in-house training on flare bartending. There's guys that make millions of dollars, or maybe at least hundreds of thousands of dollars in Vegas doing it. Being a flair bartender. There's nothing wrong with being a flair tender if that's what it is. It doesn't mean you're going to get the most cool fancy drink. It's just you're going to get the best show before you get the drink, you know? And then there's people that are, it's all in customer service, you know? Mm-hmm. One bar is not better than the other. They're just different styles. Nightclubs do offer service, mm-hmm. but you're never going to get, you know, you could, but it's very rare you're going to find a great cocktail in a nightclub.
I think that's one of the biggest challenges this industry is facing too. There's so many people who don't consider themselves bartenders because craft is a huge new thing right now. They're like, oh, I'm not a bartender like you because I don't make martinis and stuff. But it's, I can't bust out 20 rum and cokes in 5 minutes like you are. I can't do that fancy flair trick. A lot of people think that they're not a bartender nowadays, and that stigma is like slowly evening out, I think.
Like the term mixologist was like fun and whatever, like when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then now it's overused. And now it's used as a negative connotation almost. Like to me, like I'd rather just be called, you know, a bartender, a guy that makes good drinks. You know, mm-hmm. I'm here to do a service for you. You know, the guys that did it 100 years ago before me, yeah, they were just your bartender, but they weren't just your bartender. They didn't just make your drink, you know?
Uh-huh.
They'd have whatever, they'd cure whatever ails you. They would be the shoulder to cry on. They'd give you advice. They'd give you a witty comeback. They'd be, you know, the sage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's like the very few people that can actually go bartend and rail out drinks in a nightclub, and the guys that can go work in a mixology bar. That can do both. It's really funny because you'll see them and they'll go talk to the guys in the nightclubs, and the nightclub's like, oh, this is the mixology guy, this and that. He's going, you know, going to make a drink in a half an hour, you know, hold on to your horses, you know. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, the same thing, like those guys can't make good drinks. It's very few that you get somebody that can do both, that's willing to do both.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then I think here in Colorado, the beer world is massive, and beer tenders are just as knowledgeable, if not more, in certain areas when it comes to beer. And a lot of people downplay that, like, oh, I can pour a beer. There's a lot more to it. There's a lot, I think.
Yeah, they have their own accreditation, like a sommelier. They're a cicerone now.
Uh-huh.
So then they have, you know, all the nuances. And, you know, craft beer blew up big here, you know, and it's not that it's going away, but it's definitely not as big as prevalent as it was. You're starting to see some of the little guys disappear, but and some of the big guys are still there. And you know, there's people's palates 10 years ago, you'd sit there and you'd watch people come up and drink pale ales, and pale ales were the most popular beer, it felt like to me, you know. And you know, then every once in a while you get the guy that would drink Stone's Arrogant Bastard. You know, every once in a while you get like an IPA, or you do a celebration ale from like Sierra Nevada for over the weekend, or the weekend, over the holidays and stuff when that was released. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't as common as you'd see it. Now you see people drinking, you know, Gozas and Sours and IPAs and double IPAs and triple box and whatever. I mean, I'm not a beer guy, but people's palates have expanded and changed a lot as it was to what it was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's going to keep changing.
No, yeah, completely.
Mm-hmm. As I got introduced to you from Dustin, I asked him who were some of his mentors. He said nothing but great things, and how he became the bartender he is today because you helped him out a lot. Who were some of your mentors that helped you out when you first got started?
I opened up the Marriott at Desert Ridge, and I was running Vista Lounge. And when I was there, I ended up getting lucky enough to where they would send me to the corporate office and I'd help write corporate drinks because they knew I knew my stuff. I had my palate together and I was like doing this stuff, and they're like, well, let's just send Matt to go. And so I was go to Bethesda. There I met a guy named Ryan McGarren. He's out of Portland, I believe, is where he's at now. He's gone on to do other stuff. He partnered up with Kathy Casey for a while. He's one of the guys that helped create Aviation Gin. And he had all these weird, at the time to me, they were weird drinks, old, you know, vintage drinks and weird recipes. And we would take those and tweak them and modify them for the week that we were out there. And we'd create, you know, two programs. We'd do a summer program and a winter program mm-hmm. for Marriott's to launch nationwide. So it was kind of cool. And he was one of the ones that first started doing that. And then right around that same time, Arizona just was about to start forming the USBG.
Uh-huh.
So there was like six or seven of us. I think there's 10 original members, that were interested in doing this. And then we saw there was bartending competitions, and then we could start traveling the country and start making money and winning trips and doing whatever. And it wasn't ever about fame. It was just, honestly, it was about, cool, you're going to take us to San Francisco to go make drinks for somebody?
Yeah.
Awesome. You're going to take us to Vegas and you're going to give us like $500? Sweet. That was never famous. It was like, we just give us a free trip and give us the money. It was awesome.
It was all about fun.
And then at that point, there was a handful of us here in Arizona that kind of, we all just like fed off each other and just went off the competitions. And then we trade off wins and victories and losses and stuff, which was kind of fun and cool. So it was, we started as like a small little community going against each other. Then some of us went certain ways. Some of us went like really geeky, like mixology. Some of us went like the, what's the term? I'm going to start using chemicals and stuff.
Oh, I've heard of this.
Molecular.
Uh-huh.
Some people went like molecular and they went really delved into that. Some people went completely old school. Some people went back to clubs because money was there, you know, but we all kind of like just kept in contact and all kind of just did our own little thing. Kind of cool.
So you were part of that original 10 though.
I was one of the original 10.
I bet that was a cool experience seeing everyone kind of go their own way and own style, but have so many backgrounds, but be a bartender community.
Yeah, and you had a couple of guys that went and sat there, and they went and opened up their own bars and restaurants. A couple of guys went and became brand ambassadors. A couple of guys went and worked for a liquor distributor, became mixology, head of mixology. Some guys, you know, created their own little empire. Some people just went and ran hotel programs. I mean, it was wherever you kind of like fell is where you fell, but we still like took our craft further.
Okay, so you would say that group of individuals, the starting 10, were kind of mentors all to each other.
We kind of, yeah, mentored each other a little bit. And then we all kind of like just ended up with not like our own little proteges, but just like our own little areas and like kind of like helped other people along the way.
So with this industry, as we talked about, there's a lot of high turnover and kind of burnout because lot of people are working so many shifts, and some go drink, some just like you were doing, work in school and work, school, just overload. How'd you manage to find stability within the career?
I always had a good support system, whether it be friends or girlfriends or whatever, my family as well. I see alcohol get to a lot of the bartenders here. So you working, you have a stressful night, you know, first thing you want to do is to relax and cut loose is go have a drink. And then go have another drink, then have a couple of drinks, you know, and you're not getting off until, if you're closing the bar down until 2, so which means you're probably not out of there until 3 because you still got to clean and close the bar and count money and do all that fun stuff and do paperwork. And then you're up until like 5 because you're trying to wind down, or you're having a couple of drinks, so you're up until 6. And it can become a weird, like, night owl, just like you don't see much daylight, or you see, you know, just all you are is just like drinking, or you're just spending all your time in a bar. So if you can get somebody to find other outlets or do other things besides just go hang out in a bar, I mean, that always kind of helped me out.
What were some of the outlets that you would use?
I had buddies in different industries. So I had a buddy that worked at a golf course.
Oh, nice.
He'd get me out there at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, first tee time or whenever, you know, the course would get done with the frost warning or whatever. We get out, we go play. So like either I'd still be up from the night before, or I'd go take a couple hour nap and I knew I had to be up so that I could go play golf. You know, it was just, it got me doing something different. So I'm not just going to go to the bar, you know. Schoolwork was obviously important because I spent a lot of money on school. So that kept me from like getting drunk all the time or going to a movie or going to do whatever.
Just different outlets.
Just different outlets, different friends, different things. Everybody had their own kind of thing that they're into.
So as you keep growing and move through this industry, you're a rep now. What motivated you and kept you driven in this industry?
I left because I wasn't sure that I wanted to own a bar, and I was tired of working for somebody, working my life away for somebody else's money. So I would work on opening a restaurant and opening a bar. I would devote myself to it, and you work 80 to 100 hours a week, which is a ton. You do that for your first 3, 4, 6 months on opening a bar up, because it's kind of what it takes to make sure that everything's there. You kind of want to make sure that it can run smooth, and it takes over your life. And it does that also. It means you sacrifice relationships at times. So I've lost relationships that I truly miss, and but it's something I have to deal with now. So I kind of realized I wanted to see, still kind of be in the industry, but not have it take over and rule my life. So a new outlet would be go work for a brand, be a brand ambassador, or work for a liquor distributor, or become work for a supplier. So I went and started reaching out to people, and this was the first one that I found. And I started out as a mixologist for Southern Glaciers Wine and Spirits. Mm-hmm. And now I've been a sales rep.
So you loved the industry. You just wanted to find a different way to stay in it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then how are you enjoying the transition so far?
It's good. It's different. Different beast, different animal.
Mm-hmm.
I still get to sit here and work with some accounts. Some accounts still use me and utilize me as from my mixology days and stuff like that. And I sit there and we talk about cocktails and we brainstorm and we shoot off each other and just like we'll feed, you know, off each other and like, hey, I was thinking about using this, and then I'm thinking about this, and then we kind of like throw the two together, and then we take that and we mold it into this third outcome. And usually for either like the third or fourth revision of it, it's like something really cool that it's like, well, who made it? Did I make it? Did you make it? And it kind of just kind of naturally came out, which was kind of cool. Other accounts, you know, it's kind of cool that I get to sit there and I help them like figure out, you know, cool promos and cool specials and cool events and cool, you know, so I get to help run 50, 60, 100 bars now versus, you know, just running one or two.
Mm-hmm. And then you get to probably use different event ideas for different style bars instead of just that one niche of just one.
Yeah. Your nightclub's going to do something completely different than your cocktail bar, which is going to do something different than your hotel bar. which is going to do something different than the neighborhood bar and the sports bar and the strip club. They all do different styles of events and themes and promos, and they all actually drink different stuff, which is kind of weird too.
Is there any promo you're working on right now that's kind of pushing the envelope or a crazy new idea that you'd like to share?
I don't know of anything crazy new idea. I think pretty much the envelopes have all been made. They're just getting repackaged now.
Uh-huh.
I mean, everything that's ever been done in the cocktail has already been done, and just, you can just repackage it. You know, there's not much else. All the cocktails have been made. We're just making them differently, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Someone's already come up with a drink before. They just didn't get as famous as like the martini or the Negroni.
Right. I guarantee somebody else has made this, but it just never hit or never took popular or famous or whatever.
Okay.
I mean, the only time drinks change is when you add Saint Germain. Saint Germain is an older flower liqueur. I guarantee you somebody made an older flower syrup a long time ago, or even maybe not too long ago. So, I mean, the flavor of the cocktail is still there. It might not be made of Saint Germain, but I mean, they had this older flower cordial or syrup that they made.
There's almost everything's been made. It's just whether people are trying it is the question.
Yeah, we can't make new foods and new ingredients. So, I mean, we're just using them in different ways, I guess.
Like a lot of people, I don't know if you've seen this, a lot of people are playing around with tobacco and the dangers in that and everything.
And then especially in California and Colorado, where cannabis is legal, they're actually using cannabis in cocktails now too. You've seen all the dispensaries now and like the small like milligrams and this and that, and people are eating very set amounts. And I mean, like, it's gotten down to a science on for food. I mean, there's drinks right there with it. People worried more about alcohol before they worried about food. I mean, the Bottled and Bond Act was created for the FDA, which is kind of funny to think about it.
Really?
Yeah, they were concerned more about their alcohol before we were concerned about the quality of our food.
That's very interesting. When you were behind the bar, what was your number one rule and why?
Don't bring baggage with you. You're always on show. So if you had a bad day, I didn't need to know about it. I didn't need to hear about it. You're sitting here and I needed you to be on point because people are coming in here to hear, to tell you their woes or to hear your jokes or tell you jokes or to celebrate with you or to cry with you. I mean, people drink to celebrate for every reason there is. There's a reason why, that's one reason why somebody will drink, it seems like. You get a promotion. Sweet, let's celebrate. Let's pop some champagne. You're having a baby. Sweet, let's pop some champagne. Let's have a cocktail, you know. I got fired. Shit, man, I'm sorry. Let's go get drunk. My girlfriend broke up with you. Sweet, let's go to the bar and find you a new girl. I mean, there's a new reason it seems like everybody would drink. So they didn't need to come in and have my bullshit or the other bartender's bullshit affect them. And if it was that bad, then you shouldn't even be here at the first place. You should be handling stuff. So, if, you know, if you're getting evicted, why are you here at work? You need to go take care of your stuff and move, find a new place to live. If there's a death in the family, definitely don't be here, you know? Go deal with family stuff, you know? But if it was petty, minus fuel stuff, nobody needs to hear about that from you.
Check in, check out. And then when you leave, you can pick it back up.
Yeah. I mean, you like, I'm not saying like lie to your guests either. There's times where you come in and Billy Bob comes into your bar 4 or 5 days a week and he sits down and talks to you and you guys create this friendship and this kinship. I'm not telling you to lie and be fake to his face. You know, if he asks you and you want to tell him an honest question, yeah, but I don't need you to be moping behind the bar. I don't need you to be sad and I don't need you, you know, to be like, woe is me.
Now that you're in the rep world, what are some obstacles that you're overcoming?
People thinking that small boutique is better.
Explain that.
Big brands. People think big brands aren't cool. People talk down about certain brands or like, oh, it's not cool because it's not small and niche and it's not craft. If there's no such, there's not a legal definition for small batch. So because I make it out of my backyard and I make, you know, 10 barrels and this is all I can sell, is that small batch? Is Knob Creek small batch? I mean, size and scale, technically, I mean, there's a huge difference. There's not a legal definition for it.
Yeah.
People talk bad about Patron. Patron created the ultra premium tequila market. I mean, if anybody, you know, a lot of these brands should be, thank you, Patron, for making people appreciate higher quality, better tequila than, you know, Montezuma's Revenge or some, you know, tequila that's got like a worm that nobody knew about or something that was just like you got this nasty hangover from, you know, like there's actually great sipping tequilas now that people appreciate.
Yeah.
And it brought it to the forefront. You know, they're like, oh yeah, but they compromised themselves. No, you actually research it and noticed it. No, they've done it the right way. They still use it to hone it. They still do this. They still do that. You know, they haven't cut corners or quality at all.
They just scaled it larger.
They just scaled it larger. They made their distillery bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And you can either cut corners or you can make a distillery bigger. What they do, they did. They made their distillery bigger. There's a lot of brands that are like that. They get bad nomenclatures.
Mm-hmm.
They're number one. They're the biggest tequila. They're the biggest whiskey. They're the biggest vodka brand in the world for certain reasons. Just because it's, you know, a good product and they do it well and they do it efficiently and there's a good value for it. And the other thing I don't understand that trying to get people to do is like, if it's the number one whiskey in the world, which I think is Jack Daniels, shouldn't that be in your bar? Isn't that an easy sell for you? Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, Jameson, which I think are like 1, 2, and 4 on like the whiskeys in the world. I think they should be in every bar. I mean, if they're being drank at home, why won't they be drinking them in your bar? It's an easy sell that way. Same thing for Patron. Patron sells more tequila than I believe any other brand.
Do you think you see more pushback from bartenders trying to not carry the product, or just when you talk to the average consumer, like, oh, why do you even carry that big brand? No one likes that anymore.
I think it's the bartenders thinking they know what's better. They know what's best. They want to be, you know, they want the small niche, the only place that you can ever find it. But yet you look at it like these same niche, small little bars all do the same thing with the same tequila or whatever.
What are some ways you kind of educate them on that then?
Talking about the history of the brands, talking about the quality of the product, blind tasting people on it, finding whatever they think is the greatest thing, and finding equivalents that are mainstays or that are brands that have been around for, you know, since Prohibition or if not even before Prohibition, older brands.
Just educating people, pretty much.
Just kind of educating, kind of showing, kind of not trying to boss and tell them you're wrong, but kind of just try to open eyes. I think quality at the end of the day shows through. So if you can get somebody to realize this is a quality product and this is actually, you know, made better, stronger, cheaper, I mean, why wouldn't you use it? It doesn't have to be cheaper, but I mean, if it's made better and like trying to use like some like this new fancy vodka is made out of like a Peruvian muskrat or like dehydrated rain or whatever these are, that a lot of these are just marketing terms that some marketing guy came up with. That's not a real thing, but like it sounds really cool. And it's like, oh cool, so you're using, you know, something 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 water. Oh, so you're just using river water. No, but it's Arctic glacier this and that and whatever. And then it's like, so it's mountain river water. Okay, cool. It's some guy that's came up with a marketing term that's lying to you, making it think that it's better than this and that, just because he's got a better vocabulary or something like that, or a bigger imagination.
So with that, with the trends and everything, where do you see this whole scene going? Like, everyone still thinks cocktails and the craft is the next big thing. I think that revolution's over. I think we're going to be on kind of a steady slope. What do you think the next big trend will be?
I think super geeky mixology-ness is not over, but I think it's going to slow down. I think what you're going to see is more fast, actionable craft. People still using fresh juice, fresh fruits, and fresh this and that, but the times with, you know, like super composed drinks with tweezers and 13, 14 steps, I think that's going to go away. I think drink times are going to get faster. Drinks are still going to stay just as good, you know, with fresh qualities, you know, get rid of the artificial sugars, which is what's nice to see those are going away. But I think we'll stay here for a little bit. I think people are, you're getting educated palates, and drinking seems to be, it's cyclical. It's like history. So like my grandfather drank scotch. My dad drank Jack Daniels, drank whiskey. You know, I grew up drinking gin. I don't know why, but it's what it was. And now I drink, you know, gin, tequila, whiskey. Mm-hmm. You know, you're seeing ladies drink more whiskey now than you did whatever. In the 50s, you know, it was common to see a vodka martini. That was the, what was the phrase? A two martini or three martini lunch or whatever it was.
Yeah, three martini lunch.
And vodka was a thing back in the 50s, you know, with whatever it may be. So you can go to lunch and get schnockered and they can't smell it on your breath when you go back to the office. Now, vodka kind of went down, and then vodka came back, but it came back in a different form. It came back in the flavored craze. Mm-hmm. Now, the flavored craze is going away. Now, you're seeing, like, this huge – right now, I'm seeing a lot of Japanese whiskey, one, and bourbons, you know, just seems to be, like, small-batch bourbons is a big trend right now. Mezcals is another one. It's just – it's opening that category up. It's not just Weber Blue Agave tequila anymore. Now, you're seeing – you know, mezcals with, you know, Espadín and Tobola and Cusue and, you know, all these other just Mexicano, the cool little just plants and stuff. That's going to end up having a plateau until we figure out how to farm these plants, though, too. If you go down to Mexico and you go through, like, Jalisco and you go to some of these places that have been making tequila for, you know, 100 years or whatever, and you look at the size of the agave plants. The agave plants were huge. They were the size of these guys. Mm-hmm. Now you're looking at the size of the agave plants. The agaves are smaller. Well, I mean, you can grow agave plants, you know, through a rhizome, which is basically a clone. And it takes little offshoots. So you're basically taking the same thing. It's bastardizing itself down. So it's going to get smaller and weaker. Mm-hmm. Or you can actually, like, pollinate it and let it nature do it and bats do it and do it that way, which keeps them large and strong. Well, they're going to have to find a natural way to make it grow faster and efficient, and we can do it, but yet still make them strong and plant without just using the rhizomes.
What would you say your favorite spirit is? It seems like you know a lot about everything. I'm trying to guess, and you just seem so educated and knowledgeable.
When I was 16, 17, it was whiskey because that was what my dad drank. It's what I had access to. When I was 19, 20, 21, drinking illegally and legally, it was gin and tonics because gin and tonic was cheap and easy and I can get it for $5 or $6. And to me, vodka never appealed to me. Tequila when I was 20 gave me nasty hangovers, but when I turned like 24, 25, I got really into tequilas and whiskeys. So it's just, it goes back and forth between gin, tequila, whiskey, and it depends on the time of year and the season. I seem to be drinking stuff more neat now. See, holiday season, just went through a bunch of champagne.
That's
here in Arizona, fun. I mean, it's not super cold, so I'm not like just like throwing a bunch of whiskey down. I mean, like tequila is always popular down in Arizona. I mean, gin's good too. I mean, it just depends on my mood and my day. Yeah, I mean, I'll order a tequila neat, and then I'll do a gin and tonic, and then I'll do a Negroni, and then next thing I know, I'm drinking this whiskey that's really cool on the rocks, and then I'm having tequila old fashioned or tequila Sazerac or something different, you know. And I literally will go like back and forth. I don't drink the same drink usually several times over. I'm not gonna be Norm that walks into a bar and you're like, "Hey, Matt, here you go, here's your blank." No, because you're gonna get it wrong. Because I don't even know what I'm gonna drink tomorrow or in 5 minutes.
Okay.
I like drinking like tapa style.
Tapa style?
A little of that.
What did you say?
Like a tapa style, you know, you go to a tapas restaurant, Spanish food, small plates, you get a bunch of cool little things.
Yeah.
I get a bunch of cool little drinks.
Do a tapas bar where you get cool, like four cool little drinks and you get to choose them throughout the whole night. That'd be a cool idea.
Little flight, little cocktail flight, as opposed to just like a tequila flight or a whiskey flight. Actually do a little Negroni, a little Sazerac, a little Old Fashioned, a little something else.
That'd be really cool.
For one price, you get four drinks.
Yeah, but like we said, someone's probably done it. We just haven't heard about it yet.
Yep.
All right, so what is something you're looking forward related to your career down the road?
Just to see what comes out there, what's new, new spirits, new trends, new things to offer, whatever else I can learn more from myself.
And then as you're learning more, you told us to learn more in like the beginning / intermediate / don't know where to go. You said reading. Is there any other tips you would say once you think you've read a good portion? Like, granted, you're never going to read all of it. But once you're like, oh, man, I read like these books, these top ones. I don't know where to go now. I've worked under this guy. Like, I feel like I want to push myself, but I have no direction. Where should people turn?
I would read several books. I would go talk to different people, work for different people, join bartending clubs, travel and go visit the distilleries that make the places, that make these alcohols. I mean, these guys, some of these guys have been waking their third generation that's making Jack Daniels or Buffalo Trace or whatever. And like, it's really cool stories that these guys have that they'll tell you like that nobody else knows. I mean, that's a cool way to learn about spirits. And then also take everything with a grain of salt. I mean, don't just take one guy's word for it. I mean, we are bartenders. We kind of do make up stories every once in a while.
When you first started bartending, I bet you hear this all the time, one crazy story that sticks out. Everyone always asks, oh, you're a bartender. What's a crazy story? You have millions, but is there one that sticks out in your head more than any other one?
I sat there and I worked in a hotel lobby bar and this gentleman came up and sat there. Good old boy from Texas, had the big old beer belly. I can't remember if he was into cattle or if he was into oil. Sat there for about 3 or 4 hours, just drank Miller Lights, one after another after another. And we had this conversation. He's there with his buddies the entire time. By the end of it, I figured I overserved the guy, but the guy was still coherent. The guy was staying on property. The guy wasn't going anywhere. And we counted it up, and the guy had 28 beers.
Holy shit.
That's a lot of beer. Now, that sounds like that right there would astonish most people. The thing that astonished me was I have 2 beers. I got to go pee like a little girl. The guy had 28 beers and didn't go pee once. That's what astonished me. It's weird stories. Apparently, the guy's known. His record's 36. His buddies think it's funny because every bartender says the same story to him. He's like, he hasn't gone pee at all. It's been 4 hours. He's had blah, 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 blah beers, you know. And the guy wasn't huge, Andre the Giant, 6'9". No, the guy was 5'10", 2-something, but had a big old beer belly. And, you know, he's a nice guy. Can keep his composure. Man, he's got to have a liver as hard as a rock and a bladder like the size of who knows what. Man. I mean, is that really astonishing? I mean, it kind of. I mean, is that more of an interesting story than I saw 2 people having sex in front of me or, you know, or I met, you know, like Robin Williams. I mean, I got different stories for different things, you know, different events and that's like, you could be desensitized by that real quick. That's like nothing big and new. Uh-huh. Or do you know who I am? Some bars don't get that. Some get that a really lot. Uh-huh. If you're a craft cocktail bar, I'm starting to see them put time limits on reservations now. So you can't come in unless you have a reservation. And if you come in, you have 90 minutes or 2 hours here at the bar. Why? Because there's limited seats and we want to have everybody get to see the whole thing. So if you cut somebody off after 90 minutes and you do it to everybody, you're cutting out, you know, the opportunities to see stuff and do stuff. I mean, you're going to have different stories and different things. Like, oh, I had some guy who was in here for 45 minutes and he pounded down 12 drinks. Jesus, that's a ton of booze, you know? And
I noticed you said you met Robin Williams. Is that a true story?
So, yeah, I met Robin Williams years ago. Came up to my bar. Bar opened up at 11 a.m. It was like 10:30, 10:45. I'm in the lobby bar. I'm still setting up. And he wasn't the Robin that I knew up growing up knowing. He was very somber, mellow, quiet. and reserved, which is kind of an interesting take for me. And he walks up, Mr. Williams, how are you doing, sir? And he's like, I'm super open. I'm like, no, but what can I get for you? He's like, no, I really like a tequila. Anyways, he was drinking Reposado tequila on the rocks. And then an hour and a half later goes by and he comes back and he gets a second one. And I was just like, it's Robin Williams. And then later that night, after the event, there was an after party and I actually got to go bartend it. And that's when I saw the Robin Williams you see on TV and just him just firing jokes and hitting, you know, and it was really cool and interesting.
That was cool. You got to see both sides that a lot of people probably don't get to see.
I mean, he's an average, you know, he's a person, you know, and he's not going to always just be like, tell me a joke, clown, you know, it's not like he's always on and, you know, he's got to have, you know, bad moments and sad moments too. And he was just, you know, probably waking up and wanted a little tequila to get going, and it's kind of cool.
That is the end of this episode. Thank you. Hope you enjoyed it. If you want to reach out to us with any questions, comment, concerns, feel free to at our website, behindthestickpodcast.com, or our Instagram at behindthestickpodcast. Facebook is the same, or even my personal Instagram at Carlos the Creative. Have a good one. Bye.